League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 14th of May, 2021. On the podcast today, Vadim Alexander, head of healthcare at SP Angel, discusses E-Therapeutics and explains the reasons for their £20 million fundraise. Also on the podcast, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the seven big miners in the FTSE 100. Plus, Zach Meir, technical analyst and now Vox Markets contributor, talks about how he uses charts and what we can expect from his content on Vox. Plus, Dan Lane, senior analyst at Free Trade, discusses whether the UK is shunning tech. Is the value trade still on? And Elon Musk's comments on Bitcoin. And as always, at the end of the podcast, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours and the top five most read RNSs. By the way, you can check out both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk. Also, there's articles, loads of content there. There's an article there on E-Therapeutics, of course, raising a decent chunk of money. In fact, there's some stuff there with Zach. Interview with Andrew Newland, CEO of Angle. There's Physiomics, secures further 20 or 0.27 million contract. Velocity Composites. And, of course, COVID-19 index. Check that out. Biggest rise of the day is Tizian Life Sciences, up close to 10% at 79 pence. Biggest faller is E-Therapeutics, of course, did a big fundraise, but only down 6%. Decent chunk of change raised there. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Vadim Alexander, head of healthcare, SP Angel. You're Vadim.
How are you doing, Justin?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. And scanning through some of the emails today, and your name popped up on the E-Therapeutics RNS there, a good fundraise. First of all, before we go into it and what they're using the money for, explain, if you could, Vadim, what is E-Therapeutics all about? What's ETX is the ticker, by the way.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I guess, as the name describes, in the sense that it's, you know, it's a digital platform that they have developed, which allows drug discovery in silico. So this is an area of drug discovery that's early, you know, in the preclinical phases. Yeah. They effectively help identify targets in silico rather than in vivo, if you like, or in vitro. So what you're doing is you're trying to accelerate drug discovery by helping select targets that work effectively. And you can also test molecules against those targets, all of this on a computer. And this area is kind of coming of age right now. There's a lot of interest in this space. I think they're benefiting from that. And they've done quite well over the last 2 years. There's a new CEO I can't say he's new CEO anymore. He's been there for over a year now, almost going on two. But since he's come in, I mean, the shares have done really well. You should look at the share price over the last 2 years.
Yeah, wow. I'm just looking back to 7th of Feb 2020. They're at 3.3 pence. They just done it. Just hit 32 pence, so a 10 bag there almost. But they've come off a little bit, of course, of late. But still 25 pence up from 3 pence over a year ago. So wow, it's good. It's good performance there. More to come, though. Yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, this is what this funding is all about. Is these companies go from strength to strength. I mean, I've got to give them credit for that, because since they've come into this management team has come into this company, not only has the share price performed really well, but they've done fundraises at ever higher prices, so creating value. You know, it's quite an achievement. I think now over 35 million roughly, or 30 over 30 million has been raised. 35 million about sterling has been raised into this company. Share price, as we've just described, so creating value for shareholders. It's well backed. It's even better backed now because you have new shareholders coming on stream. It's just been a great run to date. But now with this money, the whole idea is to take it forward to another level. There is something else that they do, which is leveraging this platform that they have, their computational biology platform, mm-hmm. to go into the area of RNA silencing. Okay, and that's a whole area in terms of drug development. It's an area in and of itself that's coming of age also. And what they want to do with this money is take a few candidates through preclinical, one into clinic. So they're advancing their RNA silencing platform. And there's good justification for that, both in terms of the team. So the CEO is an ex-CEO of Silence Therapeutics, which is another company that's done very well. If you look at their share price over the last, 3 to 4 years, it's just gone up, I think, 10 times as well. So it gives you, a flavor for the interest in, and I mean that's just one company. There's many other companies in that space that have done well, but there's an AIM company that's done well in terms of RNA silencing. Ali, the CEO's experience, is bringing it into this company, eTherapeutics, and there's real good rationale for that in using their computational biology platform to identify targets to then go for in terms of RNA silencing therapeutics. So they'll find the targets with their platform, their computational biology platform, and then they'll go after those targets in terms of developing drugs for against those targets, but specifically RNA silencing drugs. Yeah. And that combination is exactly what this fundraise is about. It's to start moving into drug development more aggressively, but specifically in the RNA silencing platform, the new platform that they're establishing.
And I'd suggest, you're the expert here, but the upside there could be quite big.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge. And not to diminish the computational biology platform at all. They've done well. They've struck some pretty interesting agreements with some good players, a Galapagos agreement, a Merck agreement. These are names that we know. Merck is a big company. So my point being is the computational biology platform standalone is a business that's doing very well, and that they've advanced substantially and struck, good agreements with. That may generate even bigger agreements over the coming years, and that's certainly the plan. So in no way to diminish that platform standalone. And in fact, something I haven't mentioned, because there's so much you can say, but they have a specific focus on liver cells, so hepatocytes, and that model is getting ever better. The whole idea is specialization. They've specialized in that cell type, and it's a very important cell type. There are big indications like liver fibrosis. They're doing well in that regard alone. But this whole RNA silencing side of the business is, I completely agree with you. I mean, that could really, really be big. Because the whole idea with gene silencing, okay, so what you're doing is you're creating a little bit of RNA that you're targeting at a gene. The specificity, it's 100% because you have a sequence to a gene that you're targeting. So that hits that gene. The whole challenge historically with RNA silencing was drug delivery, making sure you get the RNA to the target cells. All of that has now been pretty much resolved. They have really a lot of expertise in this space. So with their computational biology platform, you find the targets, and then the turnaround time is much faster than your traditional, small molecule drug development timelines. You get, you plug a new target into a system that's already established, if you see what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And then that's the whole goal of combining these two platforms, is you're finding new targets with your highly specialized computational platform, specifically in hepatocytes, where you have a particular strength. You then go for them with your RNAi platform, and you quickly get those drugs into clinic. So the goal with this financing is they're going to progress a few preclinical candidates and one into clinic as soon as possible. I mean, this isn't going to take days, but it's a lot faster than traditional drug development in terms of your preclinical work with small molecules, because there's less unknowns.
Yeah. So plenty of news coming out then over the next several months. But pretty nice to see though, £1 million raise as well through retail investors, which is good, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what we want to see. It was opened up, there was a good uptake by the retail side of from the investment community, and that's been the case previously. They did a round about a year ago. It was a smaller round. I think they did about 12 million and good retail uptake then. So yeah, they're open to, they understand that. And I also think, it's done well for all those investors. So I see this company going from strength to strength. The next step change is, bigger agreements in the pipeline whenever they come.
Yeah. Okay. One for the watch list. ETX is the ticker. E Therapeutics is the name. Vadim, thanks for that, fella. And we'll speak you next week.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You're right, Russ?
Yeah, I'm in good health, Justin. How are you, my friend?
Yeah, I'm good. Somehow, we started off the conversation before I hit record.
And
we went to my second jab of AstraZeneca yesterday, so I'm feeling a bit woozy today. Not so bad as the first reaction, though. It's a lot better. But then we went on a rabbit hole of the Magnificent Seven. And I ended up on IMDb looking at who the Magnificent Seven were.
We'll leave it to our listeners. You've got to work. So your real quiz question is, who played in the original version from 1960, the John Ford Western, who played the Magnificent Seven? And if you start off with Yul Brynner...
Which I did.
I know you're in trouble because he's the one that everybody gets.
It's basically isn't it? They've all got hair apart from him.
Never get. There's two that people really struggle with. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah.
Well, I just saw his bald head. I thought, that's easy, Yul Brynner.
Yeah. And the reason it was the Magnificent Seven is we were talking about miners, and there are seven big miners in the FTSE 100. Anglo-American, Antofagasta, BHP, Fresnillo, Glencore, Polymetal, and Rio Tinto. And that's how we got onto it.
Oh, that's it. Yes. And, so miners, are they performing well of late? What's going on with them?
The last 2 days, they've obviously taken a bit of a drumming along with a lot of other things. Yeah. But it's topical to talk about them. A, because copper, iron ore, and I think palladium are at new all-time highs. Mm-hmm. And you have a lot of other metals that are pushing along with other raw materials that we've discussed on these podcasts, such as wheat, corn, soybeans, lean hogs. I mean, which again feeds back into this inflation debate that, we've been bibbling on about for ages and is now coming front and centre of the broader financial market debate. So they are actually industrial metals and mining is the best single FTSE 350 performing sector this year, I think. Certainly is over the last 12 months. It's also, by the way, best over 5 years, which is something that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And in this year to date, precious metals and mining is ninth out of 40, which you wouldn't expect, because who's been talking about gold this year?
Yeah.
Nobody. Right. It's not done much, right? It's done a little bit, but it's not done a lot. So
well, that's funny, isn't it? It's almost when people are not talking about something, that's the time to start paying attention to it from an investing point of view, isn't it?
It is, and I was researching something yesterday. I fell over a quote from Sir John Templeton, and he said, and his quote is, and let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, he died a billionaire, and he's left a very, very successful fund management business behind him, so he knew what he was doing. And the quote from him was, "People always ask me, where are things looking good right now? And I reply, that's the wrong question.
Yeah.
The right question to ask is, where are things looking miserable now? Because, and then to put words into his mouth, because that's potentially where the value and the opportunities are. And gold and gold miners, intriguingly, I think I've had no questions about them at all in my media relations job this year at AJ Bell. I've written a couple of pieces on them. They've disappeared without trace. And lo and behold, they're the ninth best performing section of FTSE 350. And nobody's even noticed.
Yeah.
So it's quite intriguing. So the miners fit into this, have we got a rip-roaring recovery debate? Have we got inflation coming debate? Because raw material prices are doing very well. Now, the Federal Reserve stance is, it's transitory. You've had massive pent-up demand. You've got supply-side disruption. You've got shipping disruption. It's just going to be a bit of a flash in the pan, and that thereafter things are going to cool down a little bit and the base effect gets tougher.
How long do you think it's going to go on for then, this flash?
Well, I would think they'll probably say that in a year's time, the base for comparison is much tougher. Mm. But if you look this week, you've had Chinese factory gate prices up 6.8%, US factory gate prices up 6.2%. Companies at some stage are going to start putting that out through the pipe to their customers, And if that's for consumers, they might start thinking, hang on a minute, I want a wage rise here. And once you start getting people demanding wage rises, that's when inflation can become entrenched. So the counter argument is, look, people are still worried about the pandemic. Unemployment's still relatively high. You've got people on furlough. People can't even go and knock on the boss's door at the minute because they're not in the office. Who's going to ask for a pay rise by email or over Zoom? You know, it's probably not the sort of thing that most people feel comfortable with. So yeah. There are lots of people out there who say, well, actually, you're not going to get... Normally, inflation goes raw materials first, factory gate prices second, consumer prices third, wages fourth, and then we're off. Yeah. You've certainly got the first two steps. It's still pretty early on the consumer price index and wages. They're bobbling along, but you're not really seeing the sort of tightness that you would expect in the labour market to drive that. So it's by no means a certainty. And the Fed and people will say, well, look, when the base next year comparison is plus 6%, not zero, then we think that inflation's transitory. But the market isn't quite so convinced. UK 10-year gilt yield is still ticking higher, interestingly. US 10-year treasury yield, 1.7%, looking at its highest level. It's even punched it through its highest level for a year. So I guess the question is, if you do think there's an inflationary recovery coming and the Fed's wrong, logically, miners might be one way of looking at it. Now, the caveat to that is, well, they've done really well already, right?
Yeah.
Even though nobody has really been getting too excited about them. So the question is, well, how bullish are people? Well, okay, I've done the numbers. I've aggregated forecasts for those big seven, starting with Anglo American and finishing with Rio. And analysts are forecasting combined operating profit this year of $88 billion across the seven. Now, that actually beats the 2011 peak of $65 billion. So you can say that analysts are actually pretty bullish, but they then have earnings dropping to $72 billion in 2022 and $60 billion in 2023. So they're not that bullish because they're clearly not buying into it's a super cycle. They're buying into the Fed narrative of it's short, compact. There's a squeeze on right now. It's not going to last. So if you do think we're in an inflationary, strong economic upturn, that could easily be your surprise. And that would also filter through then to dividends. But what's interesting is CapEx to sales. Now, in the end, if you look at the last mining bubble, we remember boom really blew out in what? Earnings peaked in 2011. Mm-hmm. CapEx to sales peaked to 18% in 2009. And obviously, in the end, as it happens in any cycle, right? High prices drive high profits, which attract more capital, which do eventually weigh on those profits as supply catches up with demand. It's just economics 101, reversion to the mean.
Yeah.
So and obviously once you then got a mining bust in the middle of the decade, the Chinese boom began to peter out a little bit. They began to worry about, excess debt. Miners cut CapEx to sales back to 5% by 2017.
Wow.
Now, whatever you think of mining, one thing you can't do is switch a mine on and off. You've got to do the exploration, you've got to dig the hole, you've got to make sure that, everything is safe. And so the analysts have only got CapEx going back to 7.5% of sales this year, next year, and in 2022. So again, the real secret to a commodities boom, yes, demand is obviously important, but it's supply side shortages on a sustainable basis that really make a strong cycle. And at the moment, the miners, having had their fingers badly burned a decade ago with huge CapEx projects, with merger and acquisition activity, with debt-funded share buybacks, they're still keeping it pretty tight.
Okay.
So in that respect, if you did get a strong recovery, it's going to be very hard for them to suddenly switch on supply in a really, really big hurry. So it is still possible that you could get upside surprises in earnings and therefore in miners' share prices. Now, if you believe that is a flash in the pan, you're not going to be too bothered. You think this is as good as it's going to get for the miners, and they've performed brilliantly already. There may be other darker recesses. And again, one that we've talked about before is oil, where oils, I think, are actually going through a similar process that the miners went through, six, eight years ago. Uh-oh, acquisitions, buybacks, dividends too high, we've got too much debt, what on earth do we do? And they have, again, reined CapEx in. They're now focusing on paying debt down, albeit they are bizarrely starting to think about share buyback programs. So again, if you're looking for where's miserable right now, I think there aren't many industries in the world that get a worse press than oil than perhaps tobacco and coal. And so you've got to hold your nose from an ESG point of view. And if ethical investing is your thing and your screen, all of this conversation is probably completely lost on you, although I would point out that we clearly need metals for green energy. Wind turbines are made of steel. Mm-hmm. That involves iron ore. Electric cars, well, they need huge amounts of copper wiring. So I wouldn't dismiss mine. I know the problem is they obviously make big, dirty, great holes in the ground generally.
Yeah, I was going to say.
There's a balancing act here, right, between renewable... Sorry, carry on.
Yes, I was going to say, it's funny how oil and gas does get the hard side of it, because if you look at, like I said, the miners, they're hardly environmentally friendly, but yet everyone's saying we need, lithium and all these special metals. And yet, and even today, I was reading the BBC here, and they said environmentalists are warning the government to ignore what they call hype of the use of hydrogen, because apparently oil and gas firms are pushing for so-called blue hydrogen to be used in providing heat heaters and house boilers, because of course we're going to phase out gas boilers. How are we going to do that? But they're saying electric is the way forward, environmentalists are saying, and that oil and gas firms are trying to say, blue hydrogen is good. But when you look at it, when you weigh up oil and gas against big miners, is there a lot of difference in the environmental sort of devastation they create?
If you look at the pictures of what a big mine looks like, and it's a dirty great hole in the ground, it's not the prettiest thing that you've ever seen, for all of the fact that they do try hard. And clearly there have been some, mining accidents of horrendous proportions, whether that dam bursting in Brazil, you've got that massive mistake that Rio Tinto made last year, blowing up that gorge with Aboriginal religious sites in it. So mining will do its best, but it is interesting. It gets a less bad press than oil and gas
now, intriguingly. Bad press, really bad press. I know.
And equally, you can say that if you look at where some of the really important metals come from, like, say, cobalt, from some of the African republics where they come from. Again, there are some regimes there that you might think don't necessarily meet the standards that we'd expect of Western, of perhaps more mature economies, economically or politically, dare one say.
Yeah, is there
some ethical challenges here, very definitely.
And is there any energy, areas that don't impact the environment somehow? There's not, is there? I mean, to create energy somewhere, you have to sort of take it from somewhere.
Choices have to be made. Yeah, there are no easy choices. And I guess the argument is that some do less damage than others.
Yeah.
And some are more renewable than others, clearly. But yeah, we can't, oddly enough, have a major drive on renewables without a lot of industrial metals, for example. It's not very easy to do. It's basically impossible to do, in fact, given current technologies anyway, let's put it that way. Yeah. So again, that's maybe something for us all to consider if we run our ESG screens. But again, applying the Templeton maxim of looking for where things are miserable, I think, oil, for all the fact that oil's at $68 a barrel right now, there aren't a lot of people who are clapping their feet about the strong outlook for the oil market, even if right now, renewables are only 10% of global energy supply, and no matter how hard we try and ramp them up, oil is going to be with us for some time to come, whether we like it or not, because that 10% is going to take time to grow.
Exactly. It just comes down to that. Like I said, if you're everything's questionable, ESG friendly or not, but I mean, like I said, everything's subjective to a certain extent.
There's clearly masses of degree there. Yeah. And I should say to your listeners that reading a few blogs on ESG funds recently, some of the tracker funds, particularly in the States, some of them have got oil companies in. Just so you know, some of them are actually pretty close to not being that different from the S&P 500. Yeah. Having read the small print, the oil companies are in because they're, quote, the oil companies that are doing the most to adjust their portfolios for a zero carbon future. Mm. But they're still oil companies. So if you're a really strict ESG investor, there are probably some ESG funds that you need to look twice at because they might not be quite as pure as you would like them to be in terms of what's in there and what's not. So like all of these things, all of these financial products, yes, it's a fund. Yes, a passive fund will offer you broad brush access. It'll get you a theme. It'll do it in an economical way in terms of fees. And hopefully the product is liquid, but you still need to do your research on what's inside the tin and not just read the outside of the tin.
Yeah, exactly. Well, always... understand the narrative and where it's coming from, because, like I say, the different degrees of ESG, I suppose. And there we go. Marvellous, Russ. Thanks for that, fella.
Pleasure.
And we'll speak next week.
Keep up.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Zach Meir, everyone. How are you, Zach? You all right?
I'm fine, actually. Yes. I'm looking forward to next week for various reasons. The 17th is D-Day.
Yeah.
So, you know, all the pubs and restaurants, you know, I'm just going
to
get fat.
I'm loving that. Listen, I'm just going to introduce you because, you know, no stranger to Vox. We used to do 3 charts in 3 minutes. Do you remember that? I don't know, that was a way back on Vox every day, pretty much. But we used to do that. So, but now you're coming on to Vox. And I've got to introduce Zach. Zach, basically, Zach invented charts. You know, there are ancient sort of charts on cave walls back when. If you check them out, you'll see this chart in there before stocks existed. That was Zach. Zach did all... Back then, he was charting stars and moons and all that's in the sun. You know, he used sticks and stones and chalk on cave walls. Zach invented charts, everyone. That's what Zach is to charts. Isn't that right, Zach?
Absolutely. I can't disagree with you in any way whatsoever. And there's actually pictures of me in caves with my charts.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's nothing... You know, Zach has forgotten more than we know about charts. So Zach's coming on, but he's also doing interviews and stuff like that and charting. Let's talk about charting, because I've always looked at charts, right? And I've always... But I'm more sort of fundamental. I look at charts, essentially, when... So fundamentally is what to invest in, you know? You do your research... And I like that company. And then you look at the chart to make sure the price hasn't gone bananas. It's not spiked up in any way. But I become more skeptical about charts the longer I invest. And I've been looking at charts for a long time. So, but I always tell people to look at charts. I always go look at, you always, it's part of it, you know? But you use charts. So what do you do with charts, Zach? Can you give forecasts, didn't you? Predictions there.
I think there's a couple of things. The first is that you're right. I've been doing it for a long time. And the problem is when you get it wrong, then these days people say, you got it wrong, I hate you, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, because people are like that these days.
Yeah. That never happens, though, does it? Because you never get it wrong, so it's fine.
Well, no, but if you do get it wrong, I suppose there's two things. If you say that, you know, it's like Eurasia Mining, if you say that, actually, I don't think it's a buy anymore, I think it's a sell, then you obviously get a torrent of abuse from people who are bullish of the stock. You also get a bit of a kickback from people who say, if you are bullish on it, then you get the kickback from people who say it's there's nothing there, it's all a joke, and there's nothing, you know, it's just not a proper company. So there's that aspect. With the charting side, I think you've probably got more chance of being, you know, sort of friends with everyone, in the sense that you might say at the moment, well, while it's above 25p, I think it could go back to 35. And you know, if you look at the price channel that you can draw from 2018. You know, the best case scenario target is 70p. So you've got all that sort of roadmap there. Clearly, if it broke 24, 25p, then the picture wouldn't look so good. So I think a lot of this is sort of conditional, and it's a roadmap rather than necessarily predicting, but you just have the levels that you can keep in mind. And I think that's, you know, if you want to use charting just in a simple way without trying to get too much into the technicalities or the mumbo jumbo, I think, you know, that's a sort of safest way to do it.
Keeping it simple is, I think in life, as humans, we are almost hardwired to make things complicated. So you start learning about charts, you start very basic, then you get a bit more knowledge about it, and you start complicating. I've seen people send me charts on Twitter, and there are so many lines on there, I can't even see what the share price is. There's pictures, lines, and whoa, calm it. What the? That's hurting my head watching that. And I think, no, it doesn't need to be that complex, is it? But I mean, someone said to me, I like Zach on the charts, he's always bullish. So is that why, are you steered by that? When people get a bit nasty, because if you are bullish, right, you're not going to annoy as many people as if you're bearish, are you? You know, you may get more attention if you're bearish sometimes, but does that, you know, guide you in some way? If you see a chart and you don't like the what's happening, you think, oh, if I say it's bad, people are going to get nasty, so I'm going to be nice. Is that because I quite like that? It's always, people live in hope, don't they? That's, if you give people a bit of hope, they're happy, you know.
Yeah, it's normally good to go to look at the bright side, and so my selection on a daily basis on the bulletin board Heroes tends to be the best of the rises, not just stocks that are rising, but ones that look, you know, they've just either just started rising or they look like they'll keep on rising. And you have, you know, it's generally positive and a nice message so that people won't get too upset. But I mean, there are some stocks, I wrote about it this morning, Turn PLC, you know, the Internet of Things company. If you say anything positive about that, there's all hell breaks loose, and people say, you know, it's rubbish, and you're, you know, just a ramper, and you're this and that. So some stocks have, you know, stocks where there is a bit of a shorting agenda, or there's some people who maybe think that the company's not quite up to scratch. You're not in a good place either with being bullish. So you can't, you know, you, in the end, you've got to do what, you know, you feel is right and, you know, what's what you're comfortable with. But in general, it's, you know, most punters in the market are long, and most people want to see, you know, how far their stocks are going. So I think the other day I was talking with Paul, and, you know, we were talking about Lloyds Bank and Lloyds Banking. And, you know, he sort of said, I think the target's 55p for me over the next, you know, by the end of the summer. And I looked at the chart and it seemed to me that, you know, it looks like the target is 55p by the end of the summer while we're above, you know, 45, say.
I saw that. Do you know what I said? Do you know what I'm thinking? Charting, though, when you're drawing lines like that, you can pretty much find a line anywhere, can't you, if you try? And also, then I thought of fundamentals. Hang on, some valuations really are a bit of forecasting as well. So, you know, you can be biased on valuations fundamentally as well as technically, can't you? Because, I mean, if you look at turn, I'm looking at the turn chart right now, and then every pretty much 4 or 5 months, there's a big spike up, it comes back down. So when you're charting and saying this is very bullish, you're not commenting on the fundamentals there, are you? Just saying, listen, it could go higher based on technicals. But everything's subjective, isn't it, really?
I think it's subjective, but I mean the two factors that guide me is that one, that I'm doing this in the public domain, and I've basically got to get it right. I mean, you could buy, you know, shares of Lloyds Bank at 50p and they go back to 20p. I mean, nobody'll hear about it. But with this, I think it's an unusual situation that the incentive to get it right is just not to look like a fool. And so over the years, you tend to gravitate towards the setups and the strategies that will, you know, most of the time be right. So I'm trying to think of a wrong one of late, and probably this, you know,
might be. Yeah, I was going to say, does anyone though hold you to account? I mean, do you actually, I mean, it would take your time, of course, but if you had a spreadsheet and you could look at all the times you're right and wrong, but no one's going to hold you to account. You get some people annoyed, maybe, but no one's going to hold you to account and say, Zach is right 80% of the time. Are they, I mean, have you any idea of your success rate?
I don't. As I said to Paul, I'd be happy with 50-50. I said to him, actually, that the trick, and as you know anyway, with investing, is just to make sure that you don't have any big losses on your spreadsheet. It's just a matter of, you know, you bought Eurasia at 28p, it goes below 20, probably have to get out. And, you know, you're not going to be there when it's 5p or 10p. At the same time, the charting should help you to be able to run positions maybe longer than a fundamental person might. So you might say, well, you know, it breaks 35 the next time, it probably would go towards 70 because it's been stuck between 25 and 35 for so long. So there are things which the charting helps you to maximize your profits and minimize your losses, and perhaps also not go into situations maybe like Argo at the moment where, you know, it's £1.55 now, but you know, it could go back to 115 on Monday and then back up to 155. It's a very volatile situation. So the charting does also help you narrow down the most suitable candidates. And I think that there is a value just in that, on a common sense basis, even without the, you know, the RSIs here and the Fibonacci's there, and you know, there's a GAN level here and Elliott waves and stuff like that. So I think it's a common sense roadmap for investing. It can be as long of, you know, longer time frame or shorter time frame as you want. As I said to Paul the other day, probably the maximum I'm looking at is 2 to 3 months, just because if there is a decent move on a stock, whether it's a small cap or a large cap, normally 2 to 3 months you can get a decent result. So, you know, shares can go from 20p to 50p, et cetera.
Yeah. But I think the clue there is in the title, isn't it? I mean, you know, you go into Zach's Trading Cafe. Now, I've, the more I stay at this game, the better the results I get. I've realised that being an investor in the business, not a trader of the share price, is more profitable for me. And I've said recently, actually, the more I base my investment decisions on charts, the worse I've become. And I realise now, if I look at the business itself, sometimes the share price will not reflect the business, and the share price can be going down, and the business can be improving. Now, that disconnect can be taken advantage of by a good investor who researches everything. So, I mean, if you're looking at companies like Eurasia Mining, you've got to trade that because that's worth, what, over 700 million. I don't know how much revenue you got, but not a lot. And people say it's going to go massively. How high can it go? Let's say it goes to a billion. That's only 30% up from there. So you look at percentages. But if you look at businesses that are, you know, generating cash flow and it's getting better and improving, why even look at a chart? The most successful investors in the world don't look at charts. They look at businesses. So you're more a trader angle, I suppose, aren't you?
I think it's a trader angle, but I think there are a lot of people, you know, hedge funds, and obviously hedge funds don't necessarily make money either, but a lot of investment companies who do use technically based algorithms and other sort of black boxes for their trading, but you don't hear about them because obviously they want to say, well, you know, we've got the magic formula, we've been trading the 200-day moving average on Tesla and we've made, you know, £5 billion in the last 2 years. So that you're not going to hear that. You're going to hear about the Buffetts. And I think, I mean, clearly, if you're good at fundamentals, I wouldn't go anywhere else. There's no point whatsoever, really. If you can make money like that, you know, don't try and, you know, if it's not broken, don't fix it. I got into technicals because, you know, there'd be a situation like, you know, Eurasia, where I'd say, well, I don't really understand. I don't really think they've got that much under the ground, and I wouldn't buy it at 2p or 1p. And lo and behold, it's now at 28p. So, you know, what did I know? Whereas the chart did give me a hint when it broke 1p that it was, you know, potentially going to go to 4 or 5. So I think it depends on your own skills as a fundamental trader. You've obviously got those skills. And I think the other thing also, if you know we're quite long in the tooth now. I've been looking at this for 35 years. I'm sure you've been looking at it for nearly as long as well. It is a bit like that, you know, 10,000 hours type of thing, that, you know, if you study anything for a long period of time, eventually you'll get better at it. But the problem with the market is that most people lose their money or lose interest, or, you know, before they actually come of age in terms of their trading. So that's why you go to most investment shows when they were open, and most of the people there are sort of over, at least over 50 and probably over 60. The best ones are really old. So it takes that long to get the pattern. But I think I probably, you know, now that I'm at Vox, it might be good at some point, you know, going forward, that I would say this chart looks like one which is reflective of a company which has good fundamentals. Mm. And there may be some situations where, you know, you would agree with that. And that might be the way, you know, that might be a way of sort of convincing you that it's not as sort of flaky as maybe you think. I think most people, when they say they're using charting, they're not actually doing it. They're actually looking at the fundamentals of the company and just sort of tacking on some moving average here and moving average there after that.
Yeah,
so
what's interesting is that you and Paul, because Paul Hill, I talk to Paul every other week, and he's strictly, you know, fundamentals, and you are, I assume, mostly sort of technicals. I'm more towards Paul's side, but like I say, I always look at the chart. But what I realise is, if you go for value, generally, and I only tend to check a chart, like I said, before entry to make sure it hasn't spiked up recently and not buying a spike, because obviously you may get a sell-off and sit on a bit of a loss for a while. But I realise if you look at value anyway, and you get good value for money, you tend to find it hasn't spiked, because if it had spiked, it wouldn't be good value, you know? So it fits in with that. But do you yourself trade any of these you're looking at, or do you becoming, just don't trade and being part of it?
I don't normally trade. If there's something which I think is really, really good, then I might take a small position. But normally, I don't want to be distracted by it. And, you know, it's. I think either you are, I probably would just retire from talking about the markets in public and just sit back and be an investor like that. I think it's two different skill sets, but it's a different thing.
When are you going to start? You're 90 odd now, aren't you? How old are you?
Yeah, well, no, exactly. I think you're about right. But no, I think the last year I've taken a few positions and done quite well. I think actually it is the last year has been amazing in terms of how that's gone. So that has, you know, last year has been my best year. Probably since the 90s. So,
it's a bit worrying though, because I've seen a lot of newbies come in new investors. And it's like that old saying where, you know, the worst thing that can happen to you is your first investment go very well, because then you think it's an easy game and you start chucking, you know, remortgaging the house for the next trade, and all of a sudden it doesn't go as well, you know, and you're in a big hole. So it is a bit like that at the moment. I know guys who their first investment was an Argo blockchain, and it's done 3,000%. They think, wow, this is so easy. And they're realizing now, oh, in fact, it isn't as easy. And you just basically become, you know, too easy. You don't look at the risk side of it at all. It's all about reward, you know.
Yeah, no, but I think that, I mean, there have been some companies. I think the other angle I have, which is obviously an angle that you have too, is speaking to the CEOs and, you know, meeting them and everything else. And that's really come in quite a lot in terms of of you know, giving me an angle. So if it is a company like, I don't know, Ferro Alloy Resources, mm-hmm. FAR, mm-hmm. I think the Xstrata, ex-Xstrata guy, boss came in, Mick Davis, they're in vanadium. They look like they've got the Saudi Arabia of vanadium in Kazakhstan or one of those countries in Central Asia. It just seems to be, and it's a great chart. The management seems great. It's the right time. So I don't really need to know much more apart from say, well, you know, probably above 30p, it's going to 50 or 60. But you've got everything in one situation there. I think Helium One was also one where literally straight out of the box in December, it just looked fantastic. You know, it was just a really good, you know, it was stacked up on all sides. I think I like Cornish Metals because, you know, obviously it's in the right, you know, tin has gone berserk and it's just broken its initial trading range of 8p to 12p. So there, I think probably in the end, one does combine the different aspects of the management and, you know, how they perform in an interview. The news flow, Tirupati has been brilliant as well. It looked brilliant from the start. And so I think I'm probably nearer to what you're doing, but I do find it very, it's sort of stimulating looking at the charts and coming up with something which, you know, like Argo Blockchain, after 2.5 years or 2 years to call the breakout there at 7p, it was quite satisfying.
Do you know, but most of those stocks, you know, are resource stocks. They are trader stocks because they're not generating real value. They have little revenue, if any. So they will rise on news, pop and drop. I call them pop and drop resource stocks because that's tend to what happened. You've got to trade those. Argo's a bit different because it started generating revenue, not as much as market cap. It's, at one point, what was it, a billion pounds worth of value there in market cap, and it was turning over nowhere near that. So yeah, it was always going to come back. But do you know what's annoying about Argo, though? I did 3 videos on that. I also did 3 videos on Bitcoin. And normally, you know, to do 3 videos on a company, I've got to be quite bullish. And that was when it was literally down at six pence and that. I got bored with it, sold it. And some of the people who stayed in it, new investors, fair play, thanked me. And they said, thanks for that. I put in like 800 quid. I got like almost 20 grand back. And wow. and that's annoying. Sometimes patience in the market. That's what I'm about trading sometimes. You can lack a bit of patience and you can miss out on the big rises.
I think you can also overthink it. So I think with the, at least if you do have that roadmap of Eurasia, let's say breaking 35p, and thinking it then, you know, and looking at the chart and seeing that, you know, the best, you know, 2-3 months later it could be at 70p, you could do the equivalent of an Argo type thing, then I think that maybe enables you to stay in longer, and then maybe you would have stayed in Argo and maybe maximized the profit. So I think it is a mixture of everything, and at the end of the day, probably experience of 20 years, 30 years plus. There's no substitute for that, really, is there?
Yeah, no. Okay, give us one chart you've looked at recently that you quite like last couple of days, maybe, that you think is going to move higher.
I think the best one at the moment probably is Alpha Growth. That's the one I think is looks like it's going to sort of push towards 12p. It's about 6 or 7p at the moment. Broke through the resistance of 4p. And I think there's something to do with life insurance policies in the US. So nice and obscure. Not many people do that. So they've got a bit of an edge, and that's something which I think you probably realize as well. The edge, you know, USP or an edge for a company is quite absolutely useful.
But that, to me, in that mind, I mean, I think why we know America very entrepreneurial. You know, yes. Why would a company come over here if it's a massive market in America? And it's not been exploited yet. Why list in this company? I don't understand. So I've had them on the podcast.
You're being cynical.
No, I've interviewed them. I've researched them. I've had people say this is the next big thing. And listen, they've had a big rise here, haven't they? So of late, and so.
Sometimes it takes coming over to the UK. I mean, you know, Jimi Hendrix came over here. I mean, you know, that was...
he died over here, didn't he?
Was a good result.
And he crashed and burned over here. Exactly. Yeah, so.
Susie Quattro. I mean, there's a few people who made it.
Susie Quattro. I can't stand... If Alpha Growth is a Susie Quattro of stocks, I'm out. So
okay, all right.
Yeah, marvelous, Zach. Thanks for that, fellow. So you do a daily thing. Check it out. It's interviews and technicals. And can people suggest stocks you could chart for them?
Yeah, always. Just send an email in zmir@voxmarkets.co.uk. I'll get them.
zmir@voxmarkets.co.uk, or catch him on Twitter or anywhere. He's probably walking around somewhere and
Exactly.
Marvelous, Zach. Good to chat to you, fellow. Speak soon.
Cheers.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Dan Lane, Senior Analyst at Free Trade. Dan, thanks for coming on.
Thanks very much, Justin.
Now, first of all, before we start, we've got a couple of things to talk about macro level. Free Trade, explain, what is that? What is it about?
Yeah, well, we're a new app for investing. Our goal is to get absolutely everyone investing. So we have low commissions, low costs, and access to all exchange-traded instruments that everyone knows and loves, UK and US shares, investment trusts, SPACs, the lot. The underpinning of this whole proposition is that we really do want to get everyone investing. So we're trying to make it as simple as possible and provide loads of educational support and guidance along the way.
Yeah, yeah. And you're saying that, I'm looking at the website there, it says basically commission free. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think one of the big obstacles for especially people with maybe smaller accounts is kind of these high fees that, you kind of have to make 10% before you're actually making anything just to cover your fees. So we thought that was ripe for disruption. And actually, it's just not very good for the customer to be charging these high fees. So we don't charge them. Transparently, where we do kind of make our money is on, monthly subscriptions for your ISA, £3 a month. A small levy on kind of FX fees if you want to trade US shares.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Marvelous stuff. All right, let's talk about some, macro events. First and foremost, let's get into, I sent you an email, or you sent me an email, and you said, what do you want to chat about? Is UK shunning tech? And I thought, I quite like that. Because we do see the valuations in America, afforded to the companies out there, 3 to 5, maybe more than that, times greater than they are over here, aren't they? But are people saying it'd be nice to have tech? But we do sort of add tech, don't we, over here?
Do indeed. And I think this is something I've trying to been talk about for the kind of last year. There's this gloomy attitude in the UK that we, if only we had Apple, we would have been come out of this this pandemic a lot better. The FTSE would have done a lot better. I actually don't believe that at all. I mean, there's just so much tech in the UK that's not getting attention. You just have to look further down the cap scale. Mm-hmm. So, it's something like the big gaming companies, there's a huge sector that people seem to shun in the UK. Mm-hmm. Some of the AIM companies that are like Team 17 or Frontier and things like that. But there is an argument as well to say that there is tech in the UK. It's just masquerading as something else. Yeah. Ocado, very much a tech firm that just happens to kit out supermarkets. Yeah. And arguably now Boohoo is very much a tech platform that just happens to sell clothes. So I think maybe the UK is a bit more conservative in the overall Silicon Valley gung-ho tech attitude. But we'll probably start to see companies adopting tech as the way that we get into that kind of tech sphere, as opposed to out-and-out tech companies in the FTSE 100.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? I invest only in small or micro-cap tech. And someone said, well, that's a bit narrow, isn't it? I said, no, because tech is in every sector. You can get massive divergence, diversity in your portfolio just by investing in tech. Because like you say, just because in tech, it could be into clothes or retail, it could be anywhere. It could be into, a portal, a property portal, could be anywhere. So you can be diverse. Because let's be honest, are there any businesses out there these days without tech?
Yeah. Well, I absolutely agree. And, I really hate this idea that the US has a monopoly on tech. UK small caps are rife with it. But then you look at things like Mercado Libre, Coupang, and then this recently IPO'd Israel's Global E online. It's popping up everywhere. Yeah. The US doesn't dominate.
Do you know what? I watched, I think it was Click on BBC, and they visited the Ocado warehouse. And phenomenal. Have you seen that? It's like robots just going around over this big grid system. And they're packing stuff very quickly. And like, wow, it's like a video from the future. And I looked it up on YouTube then. And this was like from, I think, 2018. I thought, wow, they were doing it back then. And so phenomenal amount of tech. I was surprised at how forward they were, how futuristic it was, even like 3 years ago. So, yeah, it's very impressive. But marvelous stuff. Okay, and then let's look at value then. You mentioned here, obviously, tech has taken a bit of a hit of late because the worry about inflation. So should people be sort of rotating into value now or what?
Yeah, I think, you know, this value rotation has got everyone a little bit excited, but I think we need to remember it reared its head back in 2016, I think, and just never really materialized.
Yeah.
I think that there probably is a case for value now, though. It's back there and people are thinking, well, is it fizzling out? Arguably, these old fears of inflation are going to stoke a couple of things. You know, the commodity investors are going to be licking their lips at that type of thing. But also, you know, if the US is highly rated, the UK entered 2021 with something like 14 times earnings. So, you know, if people are kind of, you know, huffing and blowing at the lack of tech in the UK in the FTSE 100, maybe that's a good thing right now, because you want to get away from tech and those high valuations towards these kind of, you know, economically sensitive, you know, businesses like airlines and infrastructure and things. So the value play in the UK could actually boost the UK, I think, for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Let's hope so. It's a big day Monday, opening back up and stuff. And do you know, talking about tech, Elon Musk. I've been talking every week. I have a guy called Glenn on, who's a crypto trader, and he's written a book on it. And just been, you know, dumbfounded as to what Elon Musk has been up to on Twitter. He's one of the richest guys in the world. And with that comes a certain sense of responsibility, you think, you know. But he's just basically pumping cryptocurrencies like Dogecoin, which is started off as a joke, just pumping it and then just dropping it. And then did the same a while back with Bitcoin, saying, should we accept, first of all, he said, should we accept Dogecoin for Tesla? But they do accept Bitcoin. And now all of a sudden he's saying, we're not going to accept Bitcoin anymore. But there was the odd thing was, I saw about this, it was a statement. And he never does that. He literally does a couple of word tweets here, and it's got so many followers. Whatever he says, he can do a poo emoji, and people will think it's hilarious, you know? So he's got so many followers, a couple of words that are, you know, bizarre and absurd, and people will love it. But this was like, you know, a screenshot of a statement about why they're not accepting Bitcoin anymore for Teslas. I thought, that doesn't seem like it's come from him. It's a very sensible statement. What's your thoughts on that?
It does reek of kind of a schoolboy losing his nerve after being told off or something. But it is bizarre because, as you say, he's always done what he wants. So who is he actually listening to? Who has said to him, Elon, come on, rein it in, son? And why has he listened? You know, it's all a bit bizarre.
Well, it's got to be someone in a powerful position. I mean, would the SEC get involved in this? Because let's be honest, I would not go on. I'm in small cap stocks. I have 11,000 followers on Twitter. But I understand if I sort of pump and ramp a small cap stock, some people may even jump in, and it's just bad. You know, I try and give some kind of evaluation or, you know, research-backed evidence when I tweet about something, and it seems very positive about a company. Elon doesn't, and he's got like a billion followers or something ridiculous. So yes. I just say, would the SEC, surely they should maybe step in and say, listen, there are people out there new to trading who are jumping on the back of your ramps, and the next day you'll dump the coin and say it's rubbish, like you went on Saturday Night Live and said basically it's a little rubbish, you know, Dogecoin, and it fell off a cliff. I mean, surely someone should say something, or do you think they would?
Well, you know, we had this before, actually. I mean, he tweeted a while ago, and I said on Twitter, and I got an absolute barrage of abuse for it, for saying that, you know, maybe the SEC has to have something in place to, you know, for compliance. Because as you say, I mean, you're not going to be able to get away with pumping anything. I run a daily newsletter called Honey, and I certainly can't get away with doing that. So why is he able to? Yeah. And I think the regulator needs to catch up with the likes of Twitter and the likes of, you know, all this social media that they probably don't understand yet. And maybe this is their first effort to try and tell him, we're on this now. You're not going to be able to do this in future. You know, stop it.
Yeah. Okay, so Monday, big day. The economy's pretty much opening up again, indoor hospitality, lots of things going on, wedding venues, galleries, all this stuff. What's your thoughts as an investor? Is it too late to take a position in some stocks, or do you think, or should you not react like that quickly? I mean, what's your thoughts there?
Yeah, it's easy to kind of jump on the bandwagon, but you're absolutely right in that question. Is it, you know, are we jumping on the horse after it's bolted? sometimes it's better to, you know, travel than to arrive here. And I feel like a lot of these things are based in right now. You know, and the likes of, I mean, even the card, a huge boost. I think tentatively there's nothing wrong with buying into, you know, low valuations for the long term right now. I think that's, you know, I think that's quite a positive thing to do. But in terms of trying to get the most out of this recovery play, I mean, you know, June's coming up. Is it the time to be jumping on that with a month to go? I don't know. I think probably those thoughts are baked in. Unless something drastic happens, it might be a case of looking for the long term now rather than trying to capitalize on short term gains.
Yeah, absolutely. As I say, you know, I try to say whenever people ask me about a quick trade, I say, I don't know about quick trades. I mean, you can't judge where the price is going to be the next week. You know, hopefully, if you look at a business, then you can map out where it could be in the next year or so, and that's all you should look at. But you can't look at weekly fluctuations and say, go with this, go with that. You know, because at the end of the day, you've got to try and get a decent price for a decent company. You know, and if you can do that, then it'll improve. You earn some decent money, can you? I mean, I absolutely believe that. And yourself, do you invest personally?
Oh yes, I absolutely do. Yeah, yeah.
Where's your area? Where's your, you know, area of competence there?
Well, I think, I mean, small caps is kind of my thing. I think recently I've been more attracted to the US small cap sector, trying to find kind of potential long term winners in this kind of environment. But the difficulty is exactly what you've said. A lot of these small caps have been pumped because they offer something that has been beneficial over lockdown. And we've seen in the US these quarterlies coming out. Some of the small caps have really come off as people have said to themselves, well, that trade's done now. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's really coming into view, whether people are, using this time to kind of reduce their averages and kind of following these companies. That's quite another thing. In the UK, I think the small cap space is just tremendously exciting, especially with this adoption of tech. Maybe some of the oil and gas names are looking a little bit good as well. So, yeah, that's my area.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. Dan, thanks for that, fella, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me, Justin.
OK, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, U Group. Non-mover day, 255. At four, Vietnam Holding. Again, another non-mover, 221 price there. BPC is at 6.41% down to 0.365. At two, E-Therapeutics down 6% to 25.58. And at one, Quantum Blockchain Technologies. And that's up 4.5% to 1.75. Okay, let's have a look at the top five most read RNSs. They are as follows. At five, Power Metals, Kalahari Copper Belt Exploration Update. At four, Physiomics Contract Award. At three, Horizonte Minerals, Q1 Financial Results. At two, Bushveld Minerals, Q1 2021 Operational Update. And at one, Argo Blockchain Mining signs a crypto climate accord. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.